Our next case this morning is Chamberlain versus Fleeman. As all parties are aware, counsel for the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Counsel for the respondent will have 15 minutes, and then finally, the counsel for the appellant will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Whenever you're ready, just approach the podium, adjust it to your level, and please begin by telling us who you are in a loud, clear voice.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Tiffany Walter, and I represent the appellant, Cherise Chamberlain, in this matter. This case stems from competing motions for change of custody for the party's 12-year-old daughter, Brynna Fleeman. Now, Mr. Fleeman first filed a motion for change of custody based on the fact that Ms. Chamberlain had moved from Anoka, Coon Rapids area, down to Rosemont, and she had did that 2 years prior to him filing his motion.
Well, wasn't it the changing of the school district that was the significant thing? Because it violated the stipulated custody order, didn't it?
Yes. Ms. Chamberlain, she had duly enrolled the child in both online school and in the Anoka, well, Lincoln Elementary, where the child had been previously enrolled. So the child
and
was
duly
enrolled.
And father found out about that because of an invitation to a going away party, right?
Well, that was technically not correct. I mean, the child every year had a end of year party. It wasn't a going away party per se. I guess that's how the child had done it in an invitation that she herself had drawn up.
Because she understood she was moving to Rosemont and going to school online, leaving the school district that she had been in.
I'm not sure what the child herself understood, but that wasn't mother's intention in having this party. It was a party that had occurred every single year at the end of the school year. So Mr. Fleeman's motion happened in the summer to determine essentially where this child was going to school, but also to ask for a change of custody, legal and physical. Ms. Chamberlain also filed a motion in response for a change of custody, legal and physical. Mr. Fleeman's motion was granted. Ms. Chamberlain's motion was denied.
The motion for the evidentiary hearing was granted. I mean, the court did not ultimately change custody, either legal
Correct.
Or physical.
Okay. Correct.
I just want to make sure
yep.
I had that
yep.
right.
Yep, at the time of the initial hearing. We believe that the court erred in denying Ms. Chamberlain an evidentiary hearing on her motion for a change of legal and physical custody. As the court knows, Ms. Chamberlain's burden was to come to court, present a prima facie case, and alleging endangerment to the minor child. Ms. Chamberlain filed a 19-page affidavit narrative alleging multiple instances of endangerment to the child. Conditions of Mr. Fleeman's home, issues of a neglect of medical care, issues of domestic violence, issues of gun violence, issues of not properly clothing, feeding the child, that he lived in a hoarder's house, that she wasn't being properly fed. I mean, just a dearth of issues, multiple issues here that would have been considered to grant an evidentiary hearing.
Do you agree that not only does a parent seeking an evidentiary hearing have to show endangerment, but there have to be changed circumstances, significant change in circumstances?
There was a stipulation that circumstances had changed in this in this case.
As to domestic violence and hoarding and the medical issues, were there stipulations that those situations had changed or circumstances had changed?
No, there were stipulations that there had been a change in circumstances for the minor child based on the fact that she was much older, that, you know, that the parties had moved, that kind of a thing.
Okay.
The domestic violence, there was an incident of domestic violence that occurred prior to the stipulation, but there were also three additional instances that occurred following the stipulation, the original stipulation in 2010. The hoarders issues, the condition of the house, that all occurred after the 2010 stipulation. That was something that began in 2015 when he was cited and Child Protection got involved in that kind of a thing.
Do you acknowledge that the last order, at the time this matter came to the court in 2017, 2018, the last order, if you will, on custody and parenting time was from December of 2015, correct?
Yes, that was an order that sorted out some issues regarding a holiday schedule.
That then would be the comparison point in terms of whether circumstances had changed, right? Between December 15 and, I guess, late 2017.
I believe that it's the 2010 order that would be the one that would the court should take into consideration regarding change of circumstances.
Why?
Because that was the order setting the original parenting time schedule, the 50-50 parenting time schedule. At that time, there was no motion in place to essentially change the 50-50 time. It was that they had a holiday schedule, I think that said parties alternate holidays, and they weren't able to work that out. So the court issued a holiday schedule in December of 2015. It wasn't a change of the actual regular parenting time schedule.
Assuming for the sake of argument we disagree and that we would be looking at the 2015 to 2017 time frame, could you tell us what were the endangerment circumstances that occurred within that time frame?
The issues of the house being not appropriate. The child reported to Miss Chamberlain that she wasn't mold in the bathroom. You know, issues of garbage in the house, trash everywhere. Supposedly in 2015, he had cleaned up the house, right? Like the city had got involved in December of 2015. This shouldn't have been an issue. But in Miss Chamberlain's affidavit, she's saying, "Hey, the child's reporting to me the house is nasty again. It's a hoarder's house, food everywhere, garbage everywhere, mold in the bathroom. It's disgusting." This issue of him putting her in clothes with feces and urine and her coming with vaginal issues, that is something that occurred since 2015. This issue of her having the food intolerances with the gluten sensitivities and the other food sensitivities that he wasn't properly taking care of, these are all things that occurred since 2015. They've occurred, you know, since 2010, too. What the court erred here is the court basically said, well, this information is stale. She can't prove it at this stage, right? Well, that's not the standard, right? The court in Amara has said, look, all you need to do is allege that the bad things are happening, right? You don't need to prove it at this stage. I believe in the Amara case, Mr. Amara had just said, mom's denying me parenting time. He didn't provide any dates. He didn't provide any facts, anything like that. And the court had said he gets an evidentiary hearing on that, right? Court of Appeals has said that when we're talking about evidentiary hearings with children and in custody, we need to err on the side of granting those hearings, not denying those hearings. So the district court here improperly decided that she didn't have sufficient evidence before they gave her the opportunity to come to court at an evidentiary hearing and prove her allegations. The district court also, in its final order, I believe erred because they significantly reduced Ms. Chamberlain's parenting time. She went from having 50-50 parenting time to only 35% of the overnights. She lost,
You add in the Wednesday nights, the holidays, according to the district court, you get up to about 45%, which means it's not a restriction under 518-175.
The court made a bunch of conflicting findings regarding this too, right? So in the In the actual child support order, the court took an average of 2 years and added in all of the holidays and determined that Ms. Chamberlain had 128.5 overnights, right?
Right.
And from 182.5, right? So that's a difference of, you know, more than 30% of a reduction in her parenting time. To me, that's significant.
But where does that leave her with? Does that leave her still with 45% of the parenting?
No, it doesn't. I mean, having 3 hours on a Wednesday, I mean, that's not a significant amount of time on any night. I mean, the court had the opportunity in the child support order to say, hey, I made a schedule that was nearly equal, so therefore, you know, she shouldn't be paying child support, right? But the court didn't consider those as overnight equivalents pursuant to the parenting time expense adjustment, yet, you know, has made this conflicting finding that, oh, it's right about 45%, so it's equal parenting time, so I don't have to find endangerment.
Does the child support order, and I understand what you're saying about the calculations being a little off, I mean, does the disparity between how the district court characterizes the percentage of parenting time in the June 18th order versus, or the, I'm getting all these dates mixed
yeah.
up.
June versus October, yeah.
Right, order. Does that make a difference given the fact that that mother was found to not have sufficient income to pay over the $50 minimum child support contribution anyway?
It does for the child support calculation, right? Because if the court had said she pays or she has 45% of the overnights, or what was it, 160-some if you have 45%, that would have put her in the parenting time expense adjustment for 50-50 parenting time, and she would have paid nothing in child support. But the fact that she was determined to have only 35% of the overnights pursuant to the child support order, the calculator comes out with a child support calculation of $11, which the court then grossed up to the $50 minimum support order. And then above that, in violation of 518A42, tacked on medical support, which the court is not allowed to do when you set the self-support reserve. So, again, we've got, you know, conflicting findings, you know, in one order, right, we've got 35% parenting time, in the other order we've got 45% parenting time. But I think if you look at it, she's only given a couple of hours every Wednesday, right? And then in the summer, Mr. Fleeman gets those couple of hours on the Wednesdays, so they kind of cancel each other out, really. And I think when I added it up, you know, if you added up those 3 hours into 24-hour blocks to get days, right, it was only a couple of days that she was getting extra. So, again, I think that that's a significant reduction in parenting time to go from 50-50 to 35%, right? And the court, you know, has said that when we look at whether or not a parenting time restriction is substantial or not, we need to look at what the reasons were along with the amount of time, right? The court in its order cited the Dahl case that said, you know, if there's nearly equal parenting time, but actually it wasn't the Dahl case that stood for that, it was the Anderson v. Archer case that the Dahl case cited. The interesting thing here is that Ms. Chamberlain didn't move far away. It's not like she moved to Texas. She didn't move to California. I mean, she moved to Rosemont, right?
It's an hour each way.
Right. And the court made...
And for school, I mean, didn't it really necessitate some sort of a change during the school year?
Perhaps it did request, you know, right? But that didn't mean that she had to be so severely limited in her parenting time, right? I mean, the court made all these findings about this child being under anxiety and stress and, you know, that just was, all of those findings are just completely unsupported by the record. I think I cited in my brief, the word stressed is mentioned twice, neither regarding, you know, the commute or her drive. Mr. Fleeman testified that the child was doing near perfect in school, right? I mean, we've got this child doing extremely well in school. We've got him taking her to therapy for a brief period of time, but according to his testimony, it was only because, he was having some issues communicating with her, and once the communication got well, she was doing great. The court also made these findings about how many absences that the child had that, again, were unsupported by the record. Mr. Fleeman didn't come in and say, hey, she's got all these absences, she's doing horrible in school, and we need to change the schedule because she's lying about all these sicknesses and illnesses, right? Mr. Fleeman said, she could have been sick. She was sick a couple times during my parenting time, too, right? So all these all these absences were, A, excused, and yes, maybe they occurred more on Ms. Chamberlain's parenting time than Mr. Fleeman's parenting time, but he testified he had never taken her to the doctor. He didn't know who the doctor was. He didn't know who the dentist was. He didn't know, you know, anything about who her medical providers were. So again, it's Ms. Chamberlain who's the one who's dealing with these illnesses, you know, making sure the child is doing well. And the fact of the matter is she was doing great, right, in school. She near perfect, according to Mr. Fleeman. So, yes, maybe she was having some issues, you know, getting to school, but that was because of sicknesses, and she was taking care of all of those assignments and things like that. The fact of the matter is Mr. Fleeman was the only witness who testified on his behalf, and his testimony was kind of milquetoast, right? I mean, I expected when I was not the attorney that originally tried this case, and I expected when I got that transcript to see, you know, oodles and oodles in testimony about how affected this child was with this commute and this drive, you know, based on the court's findings. And it's just not in here. It's not in here. The court has made findings that are clearly erroneous. They are not in any way supported by the record, not in any way supported by the testimony.
And those are the ones you've been talking about.
Right.
Mean, some of the findings, you assert just that your client's testimony should have prevailed. And given our standard of review, I may agree with you, and and I may have decided the case differently. But you said with respect to the allegation of stress on the child and how the school impact and everything, that there just is no evidence that supports those findings.
Right. And then the issue regarding domestic violence, too, is the other issue that's problematic. So I'm out of time.
Thank you. You will have rebuttal. We will now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. I would like to first respond to some
of
the
arguments. Could you identify yourself first, please?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Could you identify yourself for the record, though?
Thank you, Your Honor. Patricia Stotzheim for respondent Neil Fleeman.
Thank you.
I would first like to respond to some of the arguments made by opposing counsel regarding the court's findings as to whether or not that this change of circumstances was stressful to the child. I find that the court did make findings regarding that. The child was spending 25 hours.
I think counsel said there were findings, but I think the argument is that they were not supported because even father says the kid's child, the daughter's doing great. She's doing really well in school, and that there was no other than some references to stress made in the context of short-term therapy that I think was meant to address the relationship between father and daughter. There is no record evidence of undue stress on this child to support those particular findings. How do you respond to that argument?
Thank you, Your Honor. There was findings that the child is getting car sick in the car.
And who presented that evidence?
I believe Mr. Fleeman presented that evidence. And there had also been comments from Ms. Chamberlain regarding the minor child, she would say that those issues were due to her gluten allergies and whatnot, but Mr. Fleeman would say that it was car sickness. And so there's a lot of conflicting testimony.
Those things equal stress.
Excuse me?
You think that is evidence of stress as opposed to evidence of I've got stomach issues?
Well, and the evidence that Mr. Fleeman took the minor child to therapy because she was emotionally not doing well during this time period of all of this driving, having to get up very early in the morning. It is a lot of time in the car. I think just the fact that she's getting up very early, not getting as much sleep as a child should, so that affected her mood, I'm sure that's part of it, that she's spending a tremendous amount in the car. She gets car sick when she's in the car. That's not fair to the child to have absolutely no change in this parenting schedule. And she is suffering with all of that driving.
I'd like to ask, the thing that concerns me in this case is what was the district court really doing? I mean, in one order, the district court said, oh, mother still has 45% parenting time. In another order, it's 35%. I don't know how you get to 45%, and unless you can explain that to me, it seems to me that the district court, while saying it's not restricting mother's parenting time, actually did that.
Your Honor, I believe that there are two different percentages there because one is based on whether we're looking at this as a modification or a restriction. The other analysis is done under the child support calculations. Child support calculations have a different analysis because you're supposed to find the factors that matter for support for the child. If Mr. Fleeman has more overnights, he's the one who is likely spending more of the money to support the child. So it makes sense under that analysis that that is the that he has the greater percentage of parenting time. When we're talking about modification or restrictions, that is a different analysis, and that's appropriate because we're looking at the actual amount of time that the parent spends with the child, not so much what kind of time that is as far as who's going to be spending the most money to help support the child.
So the Wednesday 3 hours a night is treated differently for child support and parenting time analysis is basically your argument.
Yes, it is, Your Honor. Even if this court did not agree that it was simply a modification and that it was a restriction, the district court still made findings that this is not that this change of all this time driving in the car and the discord between the parents and the child being put in the middle of all this discord is an endangerment to her emotional well-being. And there was evidence that she was missing a tremendous amount of school during Ms. Chamberlain's parenting time. There was evidence submitted to that, and the district court found that to be credible. This district court is very familiar with these parties. The district court is accorded great deference in determining the credibility, and her findings are not based on just simply that moment of the evidentiary hearing. She's familiar with these parties. She is allowed to understand the whole history, the backdrop of this case, and make a decision that was very child-focused.
Well, and I understand this child, and you know, as is often the case, the child... Child doesn't benefit from discord between parents, but there's discord between parents, and it's not one parent solely at fault or the other parent solely at fault. I mean, it just is what it is. I don't understand why mother doesn't get an evidentiary hearing on her, what she perceives to be very valid concerns about the child's welfare while in father's custody, and father gets a hearing. I don't understand why one and not the other gets a hearing on understanding that that the court denied ultimately changing custody, but why does one get an evidentiary hearing and not the other?
Because Ms. Chamberlain's 19-page affidavit was full of stale allegations that the district court has heard before. They weren't ongoing current considerations. Any allegations that appeared to be somewhat current were isolated incidents and did not rise to the level of endangerment. They weren't.
But how can the district court make that assessment without having a hearing to flesh out what the allegations in the affidavit are?
Wearing clothes that are too small is not endangerment. Prima facie, not endangerment. Kids have accidents. If the child came home one time after having an accident, maybe he didn't know about it, that is still not an endangerment issue. The things that Ms. Chamberlain cited are not endangerment. These are things that happen to people all the time. I have mold in my bathroom. I don't think mold in the bathroom is an endangerment issue. And some of the other things that she says, a hoarder house. Well, she hasn't been to Mr. Chamberlain's house. So prima facie, she has no firsthand observations of what that house looks like.
So the mother should have had the child who's... Parents should be protecting from getting involved in this, write her own affidavit to say this is what I saw?
No, Your Honor. This child has already been put in the middle of this case enough. And it's clear from these allegations that Ms. Chamberlain has done that to the minor child, that she is pressed for information about the house, that Ms. Chamberlain frequently tries to persuade the minor child in ways that are not appropriate. That does not protect the child from the conflict between the parents. As to whether or not this was a restriction, again, the court is accorded great deference in making this distinction. And furthermore, let me back up. As far as denying appellant's motion for an evidentiary hearing, the district court is also allowed to take respondents' comments and contextualize those allegations made by the appellant. And Mr. Fleeman did make comments. He explained it. It gave context to the allegations in Ms. Chamberlain's affidavit. And taking both Mr. Fleeman's affidavit and Mr. Chamberlain's comment, there was not a prima facie showing of endangerment. Now, Ms. Chamberlain did get to testify. Although her motions were denied, she testified. Mr. Fleeman was the only person who testified on his behalf. She brought in many witnesses. She was not restricted from bringing any of her concerns to the court's attention. The court considered whatever Ms. Chamberlain wanted to say. The court had sufficient information to make a very good decision that was in the child's best interest. It just was not in the child's best interest to continue all of this driving. And again, it's important to note that perhaps the child would have stayed in this situation driving all this time were it not for Ms. Chamberlain enrolling the child into an online school, an underperforming online school, when the testimony is clear that she was thriving at the school that she was at. And so that is also an issue as far as the reasons for the change, and that's important when you're trying to decide whether it's a modification or it's a restriction on her parenting time. And the reasons were based on Ms. Chamberlain's decision and her and the way that she went about it, that she was not upfront with Mr. Fleeman about this, that she was somewhat secretive. She tried to file an ex parte motion after Mr. Fleeman filed his motion to circumvent his motion regarding getting a decision on where she was going to go to school.
I'd like to change your attention just one moment to the child support order. I'm looking at 518A42 and subdivision 2B seems to make it clear that when a court has ordered minimum child support, $50, that there is a presumption that the obligor is unable to pay medical support. Do you agree that that presumption would apply here?
No, Your Honor. I wouldn't.
Why not?
Because I think the court didn't find Ms. Chamberlain credible in her ability to earn income.
And yet set the minimum basic support.
Because the imputed amount of income was not a high amount of income. And
right, and I'm just saying under the statute, it appears that if the court has ordered the obligor to pay minimum basic support, there's a presumption that they cannot, on top of that, pay medical support, as the district court ordered, and yet the district court ordered that here.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't have a response on the child support piece. Okay. And Your Honor, I would like to bring up the timeliness of the appeal, that there is a general rule that orders should not be appealed unless it is a final order. However, in Johnson v. Johnson, 363 Northwest 2nd, 355, Minnesota Court of Appeals, 1985, there is an exception that because of the importance of having timely resolutions to family law matters, that orders regarding custody and modifications of parenting time may be appealed within 60 days of that order. So this order regarding the change in the parenting time was in June of 28, and this issue should have been appealed within 60 days from then. It's important to note that this did not get appealed until Ms. Chamberlain lost her child support. She probably would have lived with this unless and until the last order, and she realized that this was unacceptable to her, and so now she was going to go back and try to appeal everything. I ask the Court of Appeals to affirm the District Court's orders, all three of them, in all respects, and I rest my case, unless Your Honors have questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Dotzheim. We'll now hear for Ms. Walter. You'll have the last word, please.
Your Honor, I don't I'm hearing Ms. Johnson case from Ms. Solheim for the first time here. It's not cited in her brief, so I'd like to ask the court to disregard her citation to that case. If the court would like me to address the issue of appealability, we can't file an appeal until all of the orders have been all of the issues have been addressed. Finality is the important portion of this. In my reply brief, I believe that I've addressed this issue sufficiently, and I don't really want to waste my time on the issue of whether or not we should dismiss this as untimely. The fact is that Ms. Chamberlain did come to me well before the child support order was issued, and I was obviously the attorney that represented her for the child support issue, so she came to me to retain me for the appeal. She wanted to appeal way before that. I wanted to address the findings that you talked about regarding car sickness. Ms. Chamberlain was the only one that talked about the car sickness. Mr. Fleeman didn't discuss car sickness at all. And again, Ms. Chamberlain's comments regarding the car sickness were because of the eating issues, not because she was getting car sick because of the amount of driving. There was just no testimony that this child was not doing well under the current schedule. Ms. Solheim discusses how the trial court judge here is familiar with the parties, right, and that we should defer to her findings because of her familiarity with this case. But I would point out that the district court didn't really appear to be familiar with this case in her findings, right? The issue of domestic violence, I think, is the most telling issue of this, right? Where we have the district court saying, well, I know that there's this history of domestic violence in the transcript, you know, and limits testimony regarding the domestic violence to anything that had occurred past 2015. Well,
doesn't that make sense because the standard has changed circumstances, right? And there has to be something different about the relationship.
Well, but I mean, I guess you could argue different forms of domestic violence. I mean, in October of 2015, you know, Mr. Fleeman beat her up, right?
And I'm not suggesting that should be condoned. But right. What were the allegations or the incidents of domestic violence after December of 2015?
October of 2015. It was a lot of there wasn't any. There were issues of, a lot of fighting back and forth. But the issue is that there was a Danco in effect from October 2015 until January of 2017. So Mr. Fleeman technically couldn't have, committed any additional domestic violence because it would have been a violation of the Danco. So they only were to have, true. I mean, he could have violated the Danco, but right, didn't, right?
What's following up again on Judge Bjorkman's excellent point from the October 2015? Mm-hmm. What were the allegations of new domestic violence to support a hearing on the endangerment?
Just that the child had witnessed that. The child was there, present during that October 2015 issue of domestic violence. And she witnessed it. She was deeply affected by it, and it scared her. I'd like to address the fact that Ms. Solheim talked about the evidence being stale, right? This is just not true, right? Ms. Chamberlain talked about the child had lice on three separate occasions from 2016 to 2017, right? Condition of the home, garbage everywhere, rotten food, and all of these were described to her by the minor child, Brenna. And again, Your Honor touched on it. We're not going to have an affidavit filed by Brenna. You know, if my client had been granted an evidentiary hearing, which she wasn't, she could have found different ways to substantiate what Brenna was saying. She could have had the police do, a welfare check. She could have sent code enforcement back or something like that. But she was denied that right. As far as she knew, she was going to court to determine whether or not Mr. Fleeman's change of custody was going to be granted. She wasn't going to be allowed to present evidence and testimony. I mean, the case is different. Yes, there was an evidentiary hearing, but different set of circumstances, different set of proof, different set of facts. Basically, Your Honors, she should have been given the opportunity to present her evidence. Her motion was just as important as his motion, and we'd ask that you reverse and remand this to the trial court for determination of the evidentiary issues, for the evidentiary hearing, and then the issue of child support, which was improperly calculated. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Walter. Thank you, Ms. Stutzman. The matter is submitted. Our last